Hi, it's Diane. Great to be back with you. On My Mind this week, remember the reset with Russia?
We resolved to reset U.S.-Russian relations so that we can cooperate more effectively in areas of common interests.
I talked to the person behind that policy under President Obama.
We tried hard to have a more cooperative relationship, but then one side got off the dance floor, and that was Putin.
Then, news from the Middle East, the killing of protesters at the Gaza border while the U.S. embassy moves to Jerusalem, and surprise election results in Iraq. I asked Iraq's ambassador to the U.S. what it means for stability in the region. But first, Michael McFaul served as U.S. ambassador to Russia from 2012 to 2014. His new book is titled From Cold War to Hot Peace, An American Ambassador in Putin's Russia. Ambassador McFaul, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
When we think about Russia today, we are certainly in a very, very different place from where we were when President Obama was in office, and there seemed to be a great deal of hope for a reset with Russia. What happened?
Well, we were on good terms, and it was a pretty exciting time to be at the White House, by the way, in 2009, 2010.
Yes.
We were getting a lot of things done. We signed the New START Treaty, reducing nuclear weapons in the world. We signed an agreement to get Russia into the World Trade Organization. We opened up new supply routes to Afghanistan through Russia. And we got in place the most comprehensive set of sanctions against Iran ever, which led the way to a comprehensive nuclear deal. Regrettably, our president has pulled out of that, but I consider all those big accomplishments.
And apparently, part of what happened was that now President Putin was not happy with then-President Medvedev.
Yeah, there was some tension there because at that time, and it's important to note, as you just did, we were working with President Medvedev, not Prime Minister Putin. We were working with both, but the president in their system is in charge of foreign policy. And I think one of the great achievements of the reset was actually also the end of the reset. And that was in 2011. When, as you recall, there was the Arab Spring, there were demonstrations all over the region, and we were worried that Muammar Gaddafi was going to march into Benghazi and commit an act of genocide. We went to President Medvedev. I was there at the meeting. We met with him in the Kremlin, and we said, look, we need your cooperation at the UN Security Council, and we got it. Amazingly, for a Russian or a Soviet leader who had never done this before, decided to go along with the use of force. But in doing so, that's when we kind of lost Putin, because Putin then thought that Medvedev had made a mistake in supporting that military intervention.
So that takes us quickly almost to 2011 and your confirmation process. What happened?
You know, I'm a professor here at Stanford, and most times academics just spend a couple of years in the government. I had planned to come back home, and my family was ready to come back home, by the way, after a couple of years in Washington, not seeing me very often because those jobs are intense.
Sure.
The president convinced me to stay on by offering me this new job. And that was in the spring of 2011 when we first started having that conversation. And like many other confirmation processes, unfortunately, it dragged on for a while. Had nothing to do with me, by the way, personally. It had to do with Obama administration policy. And so really, I didn't get confirmed until the end of December 2011 and went out in January 2012, right after the new year. And in between, some really big things happened in Russia. One, Putin came back as president, or at least he was running for president, and he was much more confrontational towards the West and America and us than Medvedev was. And two, there were massive demonstrations in Russia in December 2011 against a falsified parliamentary election. And in response to that, Putin blamed America, he blamed Obama, and he blamed me personally for supporting the overthrow of his regime and supporting those opposition movements. I landed in Moscow right as all that was happening.
And he began, that is, the Kremlin began a propaganda effort not only against the United States, but against you personally.
Yes, it did get personal. And we've all learned about disinformation and fake news lately because of our own elections. But I experienced it firsthand several years ago, being the target of it. Photoshopped, you know, posters claiming that I was there to overthrow the regime. Ideas that I was plotting to push back on Putin after his election. And the worst of it was when a video floated around in February 2012 suggesting that I was a pedophile.
Oh, my.
And that's very difficult because how do you respond to that, right? What's the, you get on Twitter and say, I'm not a pedophile?
Yeah.
And those are techniques, you know, that we've now tragically seen used in other countries by the Russians. But they're difficult issues. And I think this set of issues is going to get even harder in the future because the technology to produce fake news and disinformation is getting better and better and better. And, you know, just around the corner, you're going to be able to produce videos that will look like you and sound like you, but not say the words that you were trying to say. And then who gets to decide what's truth and what's not?
But now, before we get to the future, let's talk about what may have happened during our own election of 2016. Do you believe that there was Russian interference and the spread of misinformation by Russia during that election?
Absolutely. I think the evidence for that is overwhelming. And let me back up a minute to say it was perfectly rational, in my view, for Putin to prefer candidate Trump over candidate Clinton for the simple fact that as a candidate, President Trump promised lots of things that were in Russia's national interest. He said he would lift sanctions. He said he would was not happy with NATO. He barely mentions the words democracy or human rights, whereas Secretary Clinton took the exact opposite view on all those issues. And then he used his instruments of influence, including stealing data from the DNC, from John Podesta, and then publishing it, most certainly to influence the course of the election. He used his social media platforms to express a view and help the candidacy. When Sputnik, their a company, their media company, tweets out hashtag Crooked Hillary, you don't need a PhD in Russian studies to understand who they're supporting there. And they're tweeting that in English, by the way, in the United States. And then they bought ads in various places, as we've now come to understand. What I don't know, of course, is did it have a independent causal influence on the outcome? That's a hard social science question because there were so many other factors involved in producing the win for President Trump. But did they intend to do that? The question is absolutely clear with respect to those interventions. And then the final one, which I think we need to know more about, is, you know, Russian emissaries coming to provide compromise on Secretary Clinton to the Trump campaign team. Again, I think the intention was rather clear. Whether there's a conspiracy there or laws were broken, I'll leave that to the lawyers. But those meetings were intended to try to defeat Clinton, with Russians and Americans meeting to achieve that objective together.
So the question as to whether there was conscious coordination between the Trump campaign and Russia is what's up in the air.
Yeah, that's a good word, by the way, Diane. I like that word coordination as opposed to collusion. And again, I think Mr. Mueller needs to do his work. I think there's a lot of questions I have that remain unanswered. In particular, you know, what I've seen before inside Russia and in other countries is that the Kremlin, Putin, uses money to create leverage with people that he works with the oligarchs, with other leaders, He gives them money. He gives them special concessions. And then he expects favors down the road. I know that that is an instrument of power that he uses inside Russia. What I don't know is, did he try to do that trying to create influence with Americans affiliated with the Trump campaign? And to that question, we need to let Mr. Mueller continue his work.
Indeed. Now, in last week's New York Times Magazine, the journalist Keith Gessen wrote about, quote, Russian hands, experts like you who've shaped our country's policies. He says that the last three administrations have failed in similar ways, and maybe one of the reasons stems from this belief that we, quote, won the Cold War and therefore have the right to dictate terms. Do you believe any of that is true?
Well, I can't speak for other administrations and other experts, but what I can tell you, you know, in my own book, I write about this very clearly and try to answer that question. You know, I was living in the Soviet Union in 1990-91, the year the Soviet Union collapsed and the Cold War ended. And it didn't feel like a victory for America to me. It felt like a victory for Russians and Americans. I had lots of friends back then who thought that they were the ones that won the Cold War, not some person sitting at the White House. They were the ones that went out to demonstrate for democracy. They were the ones that stood down the coup attempt in August 1991. And they, back then, I think Americans forget this, that we weren't meddling in their affairs and dictating to them what to do. They themselves were trying to build democracy and markets and push their country towards the West. So I think that that's a key piece that people got to remember, that there was a time when, and then the Russian government, you know, under Gorbachev and Yeltsin, both of those leaders wanted this relationship. It wasn't just the United States. As to how it ends, you know, it's easy to blame the Russia hands, not understanding Russia. You know, when I read that, I go, you know, I just look at the books on my shelf right here, dozens of books I've written about Russia. My first trip to that country was in 1983. I've lived there 6 or 7 years of my life, published literally tens of thousands of pages about Russia. The notion that somehow I'm naive about Russia, you can tell, gets a little under my skin. I would just like to remind your listeners, it takes two to tango. And we tried hard during the reset to have a more cooperative relationship, and we had a great run for 4 years. But then one side got off the dance floor, and that was Putin. We didn't change our policy at all. We did not change one thing in 2012. It was Putin that made a decision to walk away from that cooperation and move in this more confrontational way.
However, I wonder, looking back, is there anything you think could have been done differently that might have affected the situation in which we now are, where you've got people being thrown out of Russia, people being thrown out of the United States because of that very deep conflict?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I go through in detail all the various arguments in my book about NATO expansion and the Iraq War and color revolutions, and kind of give my measure of their impact. What I do say, I make two arguments. After all those periods of confrontation earlier in our history, we did have this period of cooperation during the reset, which suggests to me that NATO expansion, for instance, that's a very popular one, had been resolved. You know, I was in the government for 5 years, and in most of the meetings between Obama and Medvedev and Obama and Putin, NATO expansion didn't come up. It had been resolved. But for me, I think the biggest mistake on the Western side goes back much earlier. And it goes back to the end of the Soviet Union and the birth of a new independent state of Russia. And here, I do agree in part with what Mr. Gessen wrote about perhaps too much triumphalism about the end of the Cold War and not enough attention to trying to help Russians get through this very difficult time. You know, we talked about doing a Marshall Plan, but we didn't do one. They experienced an economic depression that was three times as worse as our economic depression in the 1930s. We should have done more to help them through that. We should have done more to help build the rule of law, help build democracy, like we did in Germany and Japan after World War II. And we didn't, in part because we thought democracy was the winner. It was the end of history. There was going to be no alternatives. And so we didn't think that we needed to. There also was not an enemy to the east of Russia that we had to worry about. Remember, that's why we gave so much attention to Germany, because we were worried about the Soviets. And then the last thing, just to remind people of the history, 1992 was an election year in America, and an election year when candidate Clinton was accusing President Bush of doing too much in foreign affairs. Remember, back then he said, it's the economy, stupid. And so we were turned internally during that election at a very critical year in Russia's transition, the first year of independent Russia. And so if I am giving out scorecards and grades, I think that was a big missed opportunity that had long-term consequences later in for our bilateral relationship.
Tell me whether you see any comparisons between President Trump and President Putin.
Yes, I think there are. Number one, I think there's an ideological dimension that unites them. Putin fancies himself as a conservative against kind of decadent liberal ways, against multilateral institutions, a Russia first guy, a believer in sovereignty. Those are all themes that President Trump from time to time also embraces. You know, President Trump's a little bit complicated, right? He changes his views from time to time. So, but there's that piece. Number two, I think they both fancy themselves as strong men pushing against the grain of the rest of the administration in their own countries. And number three, I think both gentlemen think that if they can just get together and forge a personal relationship, that will improve U.S.-Russian relations. I think that's somewhat naive, but both of them still talk about that from time to time, and that unites them.
They both attack what they call fake news.
Good point. That's a great point. And, you know, I watched that when I was ambassador in 2012, 2013, 2014, and, constantly saying, you know, the negative news about the Kremlin was fake news. There's another tactic that they used to use called whataboutism, right? So Russia does something bad in the world, and they say, well, what about America, you know, back then and there? And the goal of that, and I think it's really important for people to understand this, Vladimir Putin is not trying to win an argument with disinformation. He's just trying to muddy the waters to suggest that there is no truth. And if there is no truth, then that helps him to advance his agenda. And I fear sometimes that President Trump is using similar tactics inside our own country. And it really disturbs me, because if we don't have agreement about basic facts, and I say this as a professor who's been, you know, constrained by using facts, you can't get away with false facts in my profession. If we continue along this line, I think it's going to be very difficult to have, you know, substantive debates about policy if we can't agree about basic facts.
But what you're telling me is so fascinating, because we never heard here in this country about that, quote, fake news until the 2016 election was about to take place. So what you're saying is that Trump borrowed that phrase and that approach from Putin. Is that true?
Well, I don't know that to be true. There are definitely advisors that he had that admired and studied Putin. Steve Bannon was one of them. And with the the ideologists around Putin, they are revered by people like Steve Bannon. They've written about them. They appear on their news programs from time to time. I can't say for certain if Trump himself borrowed it, But the parallels there are stark and very clear. And the tactic is the same. It's to make people question that there is any true news. And that's a tactic I've seen work effectively for Putin. And tragically, I see that being used by our own president.
So how would you characterize the relationship between Russia and the United States today?
Well, I call it a hot piece deliberately in the title of my book to echo the Cold War, but to also suggest, as I explain in detail in the book, that some aspects of our current confrontation are similar to the Cold War, but some are new and I would say even more troubling. So, you know, for decades in the Cold War, neither side practiced annexation. That's now back. We thought we got rid of that after World War II, and Putin annexed territory of Ukraine. That's very disturbing. Cyber wars, cyber attacks, of course, because we didn't have that technology. That's a new, very dangerous part of the hot piece. And even things like arms, you know, nuclear weapons, we reversed the quantitative arms race that we had during the Cold War. And I was a part of that when we negotiated the New START Treaty. I'm very proud of that. But we've now started on a qualitative nuclear arms race where Mr. Putin, President Putin, has just announced to the world some very dangerous weapons that are not controlled by the New START Treaty, that, you know, one of them, a long-range torpedo, nuclear-armed torpedo that's designed to go, you know, into San Francisco Bay and blow up the entire city. That's what it's designed to do. We don't have a way to control for that. And, you know, I think it's a pretty scary time as a result of that.
Do you fear that perhaps they will be able to develop new technological weapons to affect the 2018 midterms?
Well, they already have those technologies. You know, they are gaming it just as the social media companies here where I live, I interact with Facebook and Twitter and Google all the time. They are taking new steps to try to be better at thwarting disinformation, and I applaud them for doing so. I think they need to be doing it in a faster way, but they finally realize that they just can't pretend that they're not media companies. They have to exercise some editorial direction. But the Russians are also gaming it and trying to figure out new ways to influence things. I don't know. I want to say this clearly. I cannot predict with authority that they will intervene in the 2018 elections, because it's not obvious to me how you do that in an effective way that advances Russia's interests. It's a different kind of election, lots of elections. And, you know, maybe they'll sit this one out, but do they have the capacity to do it? Most certainly they do. And in particular, one thing that worries me a lot is because we've had this polarized partisan debate about what happened in 2016, we have not as a nation taken the necessary steps to increase the resilience of our cybersecurity with respect to counting our vote. And it just pains me that we haven't done that, because, you know, one side in this debate is pretending that we were not compromised. And so they don't admit there's a problem. And there are just too many states that do not have paper trails for their votes. There are too many states that do not use basic cybersecurity hygiene, like dual authentication for when they are on those computer systems counting up our votes. And that leaves us vulnerable. And that's not a Democratic or Republican thing. That's an American thing. And I just wish we could get back to thinking about our security as American and not Democrat and Republican, because we are exposing ourselves and there's no excuse for it.
So, Ambassador McFaul, if you were advising the president now as to how to get this relationship between the United States and Russia back to a, I won't say perfect, but a safely cooperative place, what would you say to him?
So the first thing, ironically, I would say, is don't make cooperation the goal. Instead, define exactly what is in America's national security objectives, the things you seek to accomplish, say a new arms control agreement, right? To make it very practical. Cooperation on terrorism, cooperation on North Korea. So define your goals clearly and then decide the means for achieving them. And sometimes the means will be engagement, and we should engage with Vladimir Putin when it's in our national interest, just as we did in the Soviet era during the Cold War. But sometimes it might mean pushing back. It might mean containing Russian behavior. And sometimes it might mean ignoring Russian behavior, just isolating Putin. And I think that's the key to a successful strategy. Define the goals first, and the goal should not be just, you know, better mood music, but really concrete things, and then seek to choose the appropriate strategy for achieving them.
Mr. Trump seems to have what he regards as a great relationship with Mr. Putin personally. How do you think that plays into whatever happens going forward?
Well, I don't know how you have a great relationship just after a two-hour meeting. I mean, these guys barely know each other. But I judge President Trump by results. Okay, you have a great relationship. You have nice phone calls. What concretely have we achieved as a result of that relationship that advances American national interests? And when I look at that record, it's pretty thin, if not completely empty. So just having a nice chat with Putin doesn't serve our interests. If we got something out of that, like we did during the reset, by the way, many concrete things, then I would applaud it. But so far, I would say he's achieved very little besides just some pleasant conversations.
Ambassador McFaul, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. That was a great conversation.
Great. Bye-bye. Now a quick break.
Decius Daily.
Decius Daily.
Decius Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
Decius Daily.
Sign up at decius.com/newsletter.
decius.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Here's Fareed Yassin. He's Iraq's ambassador to the U.S. Ambassador Yassin, it's a pleasure to have you here.
The pleasure is mine. Thank you for asking me.
In the lead up to the elections recently in Iraq, the pollsters had the reelection of the Prime Minister al-Abadi. What happened?
Well, there's a couple of things that need to be said before we start talking about the results of the elections. And I think the most important thing to be said is that the elections took place. And this is not a small achievement. This is something that we have maintained in the last 14 or 15 years since regime change. We have had four constitutionally mandated elections that were held on time with a appropriate transfer of power in very peacefully. So that's not something that is insignificant. The second thing is that these elections, as per previous elections, were all very competitive and open, and therefore there was a measure of unpredictability. And polling was being conducted by a number of organizations. I don't need to tell people in this country that pollsters get things wrong.
You bet.
Okay. But here, I think the dominant feature of this election was the much higher abstention rate than we've had over the last elections. And so it might have affected the chances of various candidates.
Why do you think that was?
A measure of dissatisfaction, a measure of the fact that they don't see much immediate change in their immediate lives in terms of services, in terms of jobs. And, of course, there are reasons that explain this. I mean, the focus of the government over the last for years, and who would blame them for that, was to get rid of ISIS. And so this is an activity that takes place, on the front lines in the liberated areas, but not so much in Baghdad or in the south. In fact, to a certain degree, the rest of the country had to pay a certain price for the liberation of the occupied part of Iraq, because the resources of the whole country were geared towards that liberation. So, for example, police units, army units were transferred from the south to the north to bring the fight to ISIS. But if I want to summarize the recent developments that happened in Iraq, I'll take Mosul as an example. Last Christmas, Christians celebrated Christmas in Mosul. And just a few days ago, they, like their other compatriots throughout the country, were able to vote. And so to me, this is something worth noting, because this is the Iraq that we want, you know, a multi-ethnic, multi-sectarian, democratic country.
Nevertheless, it would seem to have been something of a surprise that the party of the cleric Muqtada al-Sadr actually won the most seats. What do you think he promised that led them to follow him?
Well, two things that Muqtada al-Sadr's movement did. They were very prominent in the recent demonstrations that took place in Baghdad and elsewhere in the country that were protesting lack of services and corruption. And these are things that resonate very much with the electorate, certainly his electorate. And because he wasn't identified with the leadership of the political process, that gave him a certain amount of credibility. Mm. The other thing that the Sadrist movement did, which was an innovation, his alliance with progressive forces was one of the other notable things in these elections. So, for example, on his list, the city of Najaf, which is, you know, a religious city and the center of Islamic learning and Shia learning in Iraq, voted for a communist lady who was part of his coalition.
So how do you believe his election might affect relations with the United States?
The Sadrist movement took positions against the United States. There were more than frictions, you know, downright battles in Baghdad and in Najaf. But now we are in a situation that is completely different. A lot of Iraqis thought that the presence of the United States prior to 2011 was not by Iraqi request. I mean, regime change had happened. They were the first to benefit from it. But nonetheless, it was not an Iraqi decision. And this, you know, might be the silver lining to the fact that the United States withdrew its forces in 2011. But now, whatever American troops you have in Iraq are clearly there at the request and with the approval of the Iraqi government to help Iraq in a very visible, unarguable way in the fight against ISIS. And this is something that is recognized broadly. And our understanding is that the Iraqi army, Iraqi armed forces, Iraq in general, still needs the presence of United States forces for the foreseeable future, if only for training and support.
What about Iran's influence in the country?
Well, we have relations with Iran that go back 1,000 years. We have 1,400 kilometers of common borders. Our cultures are intertwined. There is no question that Iran should have influence in Iraq, and that is actually a normal thing. Whether Iran has authority on Iraqi decisions, that is a matter for debate. I can give you examples where very clearly the Iraqi government took decisions that the Iranian government had reservations about. One of them, for example, was the signature of the Status of Forces Agreement in 2008. And there are other examples that I can cite. But, Iraq is a border state. It sits astride geographic zones, historic civilizational zones. You know, you've got Turkey to the north, you've got Iran to the east, you've got the Arab world to the south and to the west. And our populations sort of extend into Iran, into Turkey, into the Arab heartland. And so I think that the only model that we can have for our relationships with our neighborhood is that of a proactive neutrality. And the model I have in mind when I talk about this is Switzerland. When I compare Iraq to Switzerland, sometimes people smile like you are smiling. But what do you know about Switzerland's foreign policy? Well, the thing that's known about it is that it is neutral. The question is, why is it neutral? Well, Switzerland is a multi-ethnic, multi-religious state that had to live in a very conflicted sectarian and ethnic environment in the 17th and the 18th centuries. And so, you know, given that the wars of the 17th and the 18th centuries were all sectarian or ethnic, Switzerland could not take sides and get involved in any of these wars. And this is our position. This is why we do not want to be part of any axis with anybody against anybody.
So after the U.S. action in Iraq, it has taken quite a while, I would think, for those in Iraq to think about the United States differently.
Iraq is a country where you can have different opinions. But nonetheless, I think the trend in Iraq is to try to broaden our relationships with the United States. Right now, the dominant feature is the military and political cooperation geared around the fight against ISIS. There's so much more to be done. Let me give you an example. In the 1950s, the first industrial development plan for Iraq was developed by an American company, Arthur D. Little. People don't know this, but I've gone through this document, and actually some of the projects that they talk about are still current. Mm. And so these are the kinds of interactions we want to have with the United States. We'd like the United States to be even more present in the reconstruction of the country. And that is going to be the main task of the new government that is being formed.
What about the decision of the Trump administration to withdraw from the Iran agreement?
Well, I don't want to, you know, second guess the United States decisions. It's not my role. What I will tell you, though, is that Iraq was involved in trying to promote this agreement. One of the rounds of discussions leading to the JCPOA, in fact, took place in Baghdad. And in general, we are for anything that reduces tensions in the area, consistent with the ideas that I discussed earlier of a proactive neutrality.
So, considering the outcome of the elections, do you think a coalition government can be successfully formed to carry out what you've outlined?
There will be a coalition government. It will be a government that will be an ally of the United States in the continuation of the fight against ISIS. There is still much to be done, by the way, in the fight against ISIS. We have won the military aspects of the battle. If I wanted to summarize that, I'd say that the flag of ISIS no longer floats on anywhere in Iraq. Anywhere in Iraq, yeah. But they still have, clandestine cells. And that has implications. I mean, the nature of the fight against them is going to change. It'll be more like intelligence work coupled with anti-terrorism actions rather than direct military confrontation. But beyond that, at its root, ISIS is an ideology, and we need to continue work in order to discredit it completely.
Tell me about the people of Iraq and how they are faring now. Access to food, access to health care, access to freedom to move in any way they choose.
except for liberated areas, I think freedom of movement is available. You know, previously, to leave Iraq, you need to get an exit visa from the government. Things have changed now. Still, we suffer from the fact that services aren't what they where they need to be. Jobs aren't where they need to be. And this is not a problem that is, you know, specific to Iraq. It's general in the whole area. We have a youth bulge that needs to find meaningful jobs to become, you know, productive members of society. Like I said, I mean, the task of the government to be formed will be based on reconstruction, and hopefully that will generate jobs for the youth of Iraq.
Give me an idea of the kinds of services that are not widely available.
Well, you know, the elephant in the room is lack of electricity. We're still running behind. You know, much of the infrastructure of electricity in Iraq was destroyed first in the war in 1991, then in 2003, then the various terrorist campaigns that we've had to suffer through from 2003 until now. And at the same time, and this is something that often gets overlooked, demand has increased incredibly. The reason is that now people can have access to air conditioners, and these are energy intensive. You're trying to solve a problem that is in itself a moving goalpost with tools that need to be rebuilt at the same time. And so it's really difficult for you to fix a problem when you have at the same time to build the tools with which you fix the problem. Let me give you an example. I mean, we had to fight an insurgency while at the same time rebuilding our armed forces.
I want to ask you about the opening of the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem and how you, as an ambassador from Iraq here in the United States, feel about that opening and about the 60 Palestinians who were killed that very day.
What else can I say? It was a horrible thing, you know. Iraq is one of the few countries in the Arab world that has a position that is more Palestinian than that of the Palestinians. Our official position is to regret this decision on Jerusalem. We've said this to the administration, but like I said, I mean, we're not responsible for American foreign policy. The United States government is.
What kind of an impact do you think it's going to have on peace in that area?
What do you think it'll have on peace in the area? Not good.
Not good.
That's my reading.
You were educated for a time here.
Yes.
In the U.S.
Yes.
Tell me where.
Oh, I came here as a postdoc to work at MIT. My basic university education was in Switzerland. Then I took a year off to go and study at the Sloan School at MIT. Great institution. Greatest institution, I should say.
Where were you when it was decided by the U.S. that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq?
I was here, actually. I was
you were here?
Yeah. I was in Boston.
And how did you react to Colin Powell's statement at the United Nations and President George Bush's decision to go into Iraq?
I was all for regime change.
You were?
Yes. I was not actively or in an outspoken manner in favor of the war. And I think had I been in Iraq or in a position to share the risks of the Iraqi population, I might have taken a different stance. But I thought it inappropriate for me to be sitting in the safety of exile and to promote decisions that might cost others their lives.
Say more.
Well, I mean, early on, for example, in the kinetic phase of the war, Allies thought that one of Saddam's lieutenants was hiding in a house in Basra, and so they decided to bomb the house. What happened is that the family living in a neighboring house all died. So, I mean, at the time, I asked myself the question, you know, how would I be able to go and confront the father of those children who were killed when I had taken a position to be openly in favor of the war? This is why I did not, you know, call for it. Nonetheless, if I may, I think what you're pushing to is to get me to admit that it was a mistake to go to war in 2003. I think the major mistake that was accomplished, what was committed by the United States with regard to Iraq, was not the war in 2003. It was not finishing the job appropriately in 1991. It would have taken very little to get rid of Saddam Hussein at the time, even though people will tell you that, you know, it exceeded, you know, the mandate of the United Nations. Although that overlooks the role that the United States had in the drafting of the mandate. But still, some people argue that the United States in the ceasefire agreement at Safwan in 1991 gave Saddam the means to crush the uprising that resulted after the war by allowing him to use his helicopters. That was a terrible mistake for which tens of thousands of people paid with their lives.
And how do you respond to the idea that some have put forward that getting rid of Saddam Hussein somehow disrupted the peace in that entire area?
Well, I would like to ask them then, what role would Saddam have played had he still been here? I mean, imagine an Arab Spring in Iraq under Saddam Hussein. He would have made what's taking place in Syria look like a picnic. I know what I'm talking about. I mean, Saddam used chemical weapons against his own population. He's responsible for the deaths of countless Iraqis.
But aren't there some, even in your own country, who would prefer that Saddam Hussein was still there?
Well, now it's a free country, so some do. But they are in the small minority. You have in Germany people who look favorably on the Third Reich. Doesn't mean that they're right.
What do you finally, Mr. Ambassador, see in your glass globe for the future of Iraq, the near future, the farther-term future?
Well, it's a quote I read. Somebody asked an Iraqi at the 10th commemoration of the war. He said, well, then we had security, but we had no hope. Now things are a little better. We're actually acquiring security gradually, but we do have hope. And I think the book is not finished yet.
I do agree with that and hope for the best for your country. Ambassador Fareed Yassin, thank you for being here.
Thank you, ma'am. It's a pleasure.
And finally, we remember author Tom Wolfe, who died this week at age 88. I interviewed him in 2004 for his book, I Am Charlotte Simmons. You can hear that interview at dianereem.org. Check out the blog. And that's all for this week. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org, or leave us a voicemail. The number is 202-854-8851, and go to our website, dianereem.org. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden, comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineers this week are Danielle Brown and Al Reynolds. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Raine.